The opinions expressed on End Time do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Impro Mafia, but just because I'm wholly accountable for my actions isn't going to stop me.
Impro Mafia presents End Time! Welcome to End Time, a podcast for improvisers and aspiring improvisers. I'm Dan Beeston, Impro Mafia's tech boy.
And I'm Luke Allen, aka Big Sexy, Impro Mafia member and a member of the Sexy Detective Sketch Comedy Troupe.
Yeah, you're not on the committee yet?
Not yet.
Are they leaning on you to do so?
No, I haven't been approached, and I hope I don't get approached.
No?
No, I have...
Yeah, heaven forbid you have to attend 3 meetings a year.
Yeah. Oh, I've just got other things.
But just meddle? Meddle with the true artistic vision of the people who are working hard?
Is that how you feel about the committee?
Or? Oh, I would know. I'm not one of those people. I just sit in the background and stuff around on the website. But you don't want to be involved?
I'm quite happy to take part in certain things, but I don't particularly want to have that the burden or the stress of...
Happy being a peon?
Yes. Well, a lieutenant.
I would... A lieutenant. Yeah, good luck with that. All right. Well, enough of our banter. Yeah. We should get on to what's been happening in this month in Impro. It's been a while since we got together.
Yep.
Especially for you, because you left the country.
I was
tax
away.
Tax reasons?
That.
Legal
That
stuff.
And that. Paternity tests. And mostly for a holiday. So I've been in Canada for 6 weeks.
Nice. The birthplace of Impro.
Well, I did. I went and
if
saw...
You don't count if you don't Italy count Italy and...
Yeah, and other...
The stuff that was happening in 20 BC or something. Comedia Latte.
Well, while in Canada, I went and saw the Second City, the famous Second City. That was fun. Good.
That's it?
That's about it. They also talk funny in Canada.
Eh?
Yes. And also a language which I haven't heard before. They said it was French, but...
French. Oh, yes, the French don't agree that that's
no,
French either.
It's not. But yes, Canada. Yeah.
Well, what impro did you see there?
Oh, well, I saw the Second City show. It was...
What sort of show was it? What format?
At least what they do while I was there was they do an hour-long review, so an actual scripted show. And then
did you not understand the question?
No, I'm getting to
it. Okay.
And then after the hour review, they take a short break, and they do about half an hour, 40 minutes of impro.
Oh, okay.
And they use the... Impro, at least this is what I understand, is that they use those impro sessions, not necessarily only the ones after the show, but they use impro as a means to generate the scripted scenes.
Ah, okay.
Or at least to maybe add color or improve a script or a sketch that someone's brought in. So,
Well, you guys write stuff for the Sexy Detectives, but I've heard that you guys don't. We don't use any impro.
We have found that for whatever reason, impro doesn't seem to work for us.
Maybe you guys aren't very good.
As improvisers?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I just think maybe we haven't approached it in the right way. I know that there's a really good book about like Saturday Night Live and the behind the scenes of that kind of stuff. And another one about actually Second City. And Tina Fey mentions that during her time on Saturday Night Live, one of the approaches that she takes is improvising a scene out. And that's how you can get a sketch from just from the ideas and from some of the direction that you take a scene. It's not going to be the exact same thing on the page once you write it. We can't do that. I don't know why. We just have no.
Yeah, Saturday Night Live is more character based though. Like one thing I've noticed about watching your Sex Detective show is that
ours is more amateurish.
It's more crap.
Yeah.
No, what I'm saying is that it's more. Each sketch seems to be based on a fairly strong idea.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's about hitting that idea rather than letting the character support the show.
I'd agree with that. I'd say that Sexy D is probably very much an idea-focused sketch comedy group rather than a character-focused sketch comedy group.
So what you're saying
group.
Is you're elitist.
No, it's just a different approach to things, I guess.
Mm.
Sorry, not a different, just not different. Our approach to things. Yeah.
So, did you enjoy the Second City show?
I did. We had great seats right at the very, very front. John Lovitz was in the audience that night, although no one...
The guy from...
He was from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
But he was from The Critic, that spin-off from The Simpsons, I think it was. This is about 10, maybe even 15 years ago. He might have made an appearance on news radio. Anyway, you'll know him. You know him as soon as you've seen him. He was actually right in front of us as we went in, but then, I guess, sat somewhere over to the side. So that was fun. That was my... Brush taste.
Brush taste.
Yeah, I just suck on brushes. It's a brush taste. What was the question?
The show was good.
The show was good. Maybe a little so short inside. Form? The improv part of it, yeah, short form. I mean, they do, but not in the gamey way, I guess, just in that scene-y way. Have you ever seen the Upright Citizens Brigade do ASCAT at all?
No.
Heard of that? Okay. So in the same way that, you know, in Harold, they ask for a particular thing and that then will spurs
all the scenes. Yep. Yeah.
So they start in a very, very similar way. They ask for a particular whatever and then that leads to the first scene, and I guess it just permeates its way through. But there's no through line like in a Harold. There's no, you know, three parts and it comes back. So,
all right.
But it was really good. It was
and very story-based or hoop games?
Story-based within that particular scene. No games. You know, it was just the scenes were all, you know, in and of themselves. It was good to watch that impro, and it was good to watch their written sketch review thing as well. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I took a lot out of both of those things, which was really good.
Okay.
Yeah. And they had two women in the cast, which is great.
Two women?
Yes, both were funny. So I think that's the global quota, as far as I'm aware.
Sure they weren't footballs? Footballs. Are you sure they weren't footballers dressed up in dresses?
No, these were...
That's funny.
These were...
That's funny stuff.
These were attractive women.
Look at me, I'm in a dress, but I've got testicles.
Yep.
Oh.
And it catches me every time.
That is top shelf.
It's like a Thai ladyboy. I'm always surprised when I find out.
That's the comedy.
Yeah.
You get an erection, mm-hmm. and then you realize that it's a six-foot man.
Wait a second, yeah. Hair on the knuckles, what are you going to do? You just have to go with it. That's my motto, go with it.
I knew she was a man because she got the grip exactly right.
How do we get on this topic?
I don't know. Greg's not even here. What else have we been up to? The stuff that we've been up to.
What else were we up to?
Well, obviously, I quite effectively killed your... rookie show down at O'Malley's.
Yes, I handed that over to you. I think it was...
It was a Monday night.
On a Monday night, I said, Dan, here's my baby. Yep. Take it and look care of it. Take good care of it.
By midday Wednesday,
mm-hmm.
I had found it lying stiff in its cot.
Yes.
And, much to Greg's delight. That was a while ago now. I've already been made fun of for this.
Yeah. Having said that, you know, and we do joke about it, obviously it wasn't you who killed it.
Obviously.
It was a decision that was made a little higher up.
By Greg, so he could make fun of me.
Well, I think it was one of those ideal things whereby, you know, Impro Mafia's wants as well as the venue's wants kind of met at the same time. Mm. And the Albion show that started up since I've been gone. It's not the same show, you know.
And something we haven't discussed at all on the podcast because it's kind of been labelled by some people as the secret show because Impro Mafia hasn't actually told anyone or advertised it at all.
Are we allowed to talk about it? Do we need committee approval before mentioning on the podcast? Podcast, because I mispronounced podcast. But I said Piodcast. Yeah. Do I need to mention on the Piodcast?
I think we can. Okay. Sure.
Well, cut it out. If it's not...
It's a public show.
Yes.
We could have just stumbled across it. That's what this podcast is.
Yeah. It's listed in the performer's area of... Anyway, what's your feedback from? What's your feeling from it?
It's a tricky room because pretty much every week it's a whole new group of people coming in who don't really know what improv is and don't know what's expected of them as an improv audience. And you've got to train them each week to enjoy the show so that they know what they can do.
When you say train, I guess I probably know what you mean. But for someone who's listening to the podcast, how do you train an audience, particularly as you said, they're not a repeat audience?
Mm. Well, if you go to a stand-up show,
yeah,
generally you know that you have to go in there and win people over. People will sit there and cross their arms and part of their brain will go, all right, funny man, make me laugh.
Yeah, but there's also the audience expectation that if they know that they're at a stand-up show, what their role is or what to expect from it. When... If you said to someone, well, let's go to an improv show, they don't know that. So you're starting from zero, really, with that kind of audience.
Indeed. So most of our shows, you turn up and half the audience has been to one of these shows before and knows that they're allowed to be loud and raucous and enjoy themselves and enjoy watching people fail. That's the big thing. That a big part of impro is the fact that there are going to be failures because you're making it up on the spot, and that's okay.
Yeah,
Only is it okay, but it's that you can sit there and laugh at these people failing.
Mm.
And it takes a very good improviser to get up there and fail gracefully and take the audience with them if none of the audience realizes that they're allowed to laugh at their misfortune.
Yeah.
And you've got to win them around. Like if you can get up there and get the whole room laughing in the warm-up game or the first two games, they realize that they're in for an up-and-down ride. Mm-hmm. But if you start off low and have trouble in the first couple of games, then you've got an almighty job convincing them that you're worth their time.
Is a lot of that the MC as well? I mean, the MC has a very important job.
MC's got a gigantic job.
Setting the table, you know, getting everything right before everyone else comes in for this, you know, yeah, the rest of it.
The MC's got a huge job down there. And kudos to Al, who's been doing great guns down there. He's MC'd most of the time down there. He's doing a great job because he's got stand-up training behind him as well. Mm-hmm. So he's a bit more familiar of how that sort of crowd is going to warm up.
Yeah, how you work a crowd a little bit more.
Mm.
What about the interaction from the players themselves? I mean, there was a time when Impro Mafia, the players kind of just sat on their seats and waited for their names to be called, and then they'd spring to life. And what I've noticed in the last couple of years is that now there's banter between players. You see far more of a player's personality in between games, or even, you know, conversing with an MC before they start a scene.
Mm. Well,
does that also help the energy flow at all, or is that
we're actually behind a panel between scenes, mm-hmm. so the audience can't see us sitting there
behind a panel van with the engine running in case the night goes horribly.
Having a smoke. Yeah. So we sit there and we do bond behind there, but the audience doesn't see that happening so much.
Mm-hmm.
And you jump up on stage and there can be a bit of mucking around, but you don't want to muck around too much on that stage. You want to get straight into the games where people are enjoying themselves and realize that the funny stuff is happening.
Yeah.
What else have we been up to recently? Not really anything. No real impro to speak of.
Oh, you know what, Dan? what pops to mind? Should we mention it? I don't. It was a little thing that we did called Prognosis Death Relapse, which was the second season of the long form that we did spectacularly. Well, actually, we were met with spectacular applause.
So the bad news for you listeners is that this podcast begins what will, if history serves to be any guide, be the first of about four or five podcasts where we just pat ourselves on the back.
Months.
Oh my God, weren't we clever? Weren't you clever? No, you were clever. Oh, remember
that? And it was just, you were clever.
And then someone made music for us, it was really clever. Oh my God, and the audience was applauding them. Wanted to give me big kisses. And I had lots of sex with groupies.
Clever.
That's pretty much it. That's a review.
But it was a first, I guess, for Impro Mafia, in that we were bringing back a show that had been done previously.
Yeah.
Specifically a long form show with the same characters.
A full show. Well, we've never even done a full show, like a long form show, for any longer than one night before either.
Yeah. So this was six nights, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday over 2 weeks.
God, just hearing that makes me tired.
Mm.
I get so tired. I have to do four nights of impro. Mm. And then I was like, I'm going to need to recuperate from that. And you get 4 days to recuperate and then do another three.
Mm.
I just burn adrenaline like it's popcorn.
What changed for you this time around compared to last time around? Anything? Or was there things that you brought in for your character or you were playing this time?
The big thing was that the first time I played, I think part of my energy was going into maintaining the character.
Mm-hmm.
And this time I got up on stage and just slipped into the character like an old coat. I didn't have to worry about it most nights. One night I kept fretting that the voice was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But no, generally, I didn't have to worry about maintaining the character. The character did all the work for me.
Mm-hmm. Those who don't know, the Prognosis Death, it's about the town of St. Love and the goings-on at a hospital. St. Love Hospital. We had seven players playing the roles of, you know, hospital administrators and hospital staff and townsfolk, as well as, you know, a villain of the night, or a villain of the piece. So each night, the audience provided the main villain or threat, or
main threat
abstract kind of thing.
So they write down on a piece of paper, and we get a big bundle of papers.
And then we get to choose which one that's going
to
be.
Now, can I give advice to people for when they write on those pieces of papers?
Yeah.
If the word monkey
or
Scientology is written on that piece of paper, it is going immediately in the bin.
Yeah, it's not going to get through.
It's not going to get through.
Overloaded offers as well. If you've got a very simple idea, so let's say sharks, that's probably strong enough. You don't have to add an adjective. So sneezing sharks or...
you don't need that.
You don't need...
Sharks with leprechauns riding them.
No.
Too much.
Too much. Keep it simple.
In fact, leprechauns is a bit of a hot one. Some of us, I think, would be happy to do leprechauns. Mm-hmm. Other of us can't maintain an Irish accent to save our lives and go, you know what, let's just bin that one.
Yeah, let's get rid of that. But that's what I would say as well. Don't overload the offers, because you don't really want to see leprechauns on China.
No, you don't want to see that.
No, we could do that for you.
That's funny for about 3 minutes.
Yeah, but we've got an hour.
We've got an hour and a bit to fill.
Come on.
Don't make it overly hard for us. Yeah. We're making this shit up, for God's sake.
So we had the main offer from the audience, and then each night we had three main characters.
Yep.
And they had a character trait or an objective or a...
It was just an offer from the audience.
Just an offer from the audience. Yeah. And they informed their character. So that's four offers from the audience.
Mm.
Spoiled for choice.
Yeah, that's nothing compared to the amount of accidental offers that we give each other throughout any one show.
But that was the show. You played again. You played Dr. Ludwig Lestrange.
Yep. A crowd favourite by the end, which he was kind of nice.
I actually enjoyed him much more this second time round, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I had...
You're in Dave's camp?
What was Dave's camp?
He said, I found Ludwig Lestrange's character to be a bit too slow and a bit too boring.
Oh, see, I think I set my camp up before Dave got there and he just joined me.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that was, yeah. I was there first, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I scaled Everest first and then Dave joined me.
Oh, yeah.
Planted his flag and said...
He was your tensing.
Yes. Yeah. No, look, I found Lestrange a little slow. Mm-hmm. In the first season of it. Second season, I thought he was right on the money. His interaction and the opportunities that the Melody Carmichael storyline with both you and Amy.
Mm, well, that was a very specific attitude that was foisted on me, forced on me, was that we wanted to get Dr. Carmichael in a little bit more because last season she tended to orbit around stories rather than be the center of them a bit.
And we're talking about the character of Carmichael rather than the player that's Amy.
Yeah, Amy did a great job.
Amy was fantastic.
But she ended up playing a whole bunch of other characters in the story, and her main character, Dr. Carmichael, never really got a part of it. And we realised later that her character didn't have a strong attitude or relationship to any of the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
So your character, Medical Superintendent
Harold Dean.
Had a very strong relationship with the hero, Burton Mangold.
Yeah.
And it was one of hatred and jealousy and, I'm assuming, hidden homosexual desires.
I don't know about that third one. Watching a different show.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Who knows? And then, of course, Lottie Bublé had a strong relationship to Burton Mangold.
Mm-hmm.
And Ludwig Lestrange was jealous of Burton and secretly in love with Lottie. And in order to charge this season up a bit, it was decided that Dr. Carmichael was going to start using Dr. Lestrange to satiate some sort of sexual desire or need in her life.
Yeah.
And that quite quickly changed into an actual affection for Dr. Lestrange, which was really quite sad on some level and worked brilliantly.
You're right, though, in terms of, I think, part of the reason that the Melody character, who was a doctor but everyone referred to as nurse, but we ended up actually playing that for laughs.
Mm-hmm.
That went really well. But in the first season, I think part of the reason that she tended to be a periphery character is, as you said, she didn't seem to have that point of view or a relationship or an objective, which when you go back to, I guess, regardless of if it's long form or short form, if your character is one of those from the get-go, you're pretty sweet. You know, if I can approach... So not that we actually even shared a stage, but if my character of Harold Dean
mm-hmm.
has nothing but contempt for your character,
yeah.
but your character, the only thing they want to do is actually please me, all of a sudden we've got two points of view and we've got a direction that we're going to play.
Yeah.
But if one of us doesn't have that, it makes it much harder.
Mm.
I think that was probably, for me at least, what I really enjoyed about doing the long forms was the realization of, oh my God, short form is just all this preparation for me being on stage in this scene right now.
Yeah.
So we're going to do an emotion swap scene because at some point my character is going to be blah.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I noticed was that because I played on the Wednesday night at the Albion before I played at the Prognosis Death the following three nights.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was really working, like my brain was running at full speed in order to come up with characters and do what needed to be done and figure out an ending to this scene and mm-hmm. come up with a clever line and have an attitude. And just all of my improv training was firing at 100 million miles a minute. Whereas when I got up on the Prognosis Death stage, all I had to do was slip into the character and let the character do the work.
Yep.
And the character would do everything. And it's not like I was reusing old jokes, but it was... The character knew what he would do in any situation.
You'd already had six performances in the first season
yeah.
to smooth off the rough edges of what this character wanted and what his relationship with the other characters were.
Mm.
I almost had the exact opposite in that when I came back to Harold Dean, I actually forgot who Harold Dean was, which is bizarre. It's like, if you've seen the American Pie movies with the...
I saw the first one.
Okay. So if you've ever seen American Pie 3, the main characters obviously were Jim and then Stifler, the Stifler character. Uh-huh. And for whatever reason, Sean William Scott, who plays Stifler, obviously between the filming of American Pie 2 and American Pie 3, completely forgot how to play the character and just asked someone to describe, you know, the Stifler character. And so if you ever watch American Pie 3, it's not until about halfway through the movie that the character actually settles down to what should be or what you remember him to be. At the beginning, he's just played like a retard. Can I say that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Like a retard.
Just don't say spasmo.
Like a spasmo
no,
retard.
No, no, oh, what? God. I'm sorry. Oh.
Okay. Because that's what someone described, you know, Stifler to him as. That was me with Harold Dean. I remember.
At least he wasn't black.
I remembered Harold Dean as being an administrator. I didn't remember him as being the cantankerous administrator. I didn't remember his. My starting point for Harold Dean was actually Harold from Neighbours with a kind of. And it didn't come through this time. But what I found in the development of the character, or trying to rediscover the character, were all these other little wonderful things that informed my playing throughout the season. So there was enough going on that if you'd seen the first season, you certainly knew who Harold Dean was.
Mm-hmm.
But the little nuances that I discovered through this next six episodes made him far more exciting for me, but also a completely different character from season
one. Oh, yeah. And so what do you feel about him now at the end of the season?
I think I'd probably...
a specific idea about who he is now?
Yeah, like I think I'd probably like a blend of the two, but it turns out, for me at least, that Harold Dean was actually an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
He was a failed hospital clown.
Yep.
And how do you fail at hospital clown? All you have to do is go in there and make a sick child happy, but he couldn't do it. So he turned his back on that and went into administration.
Where he can make lots of people unhappy.
Exactly, and then failed upwards till he was medical superintendent. And I guess once I realized that you know, he's terrible with people, not because he wants to be, but because he doesn't know how to be with people. So my character was an idiot, and so I took that on to inform my character, which is why he wants Buble, but he doesn't know how to treat a woman, so mm-hmm. he says these awful things. He puts Vaseline on his teeth in preparation for a photo shoot that never actually happens, and has to, you know, wipe it off, and all these other little things. It was actually, you know, fantastic discovering those little nuances. I wish I'd had it from day one. That was I think coming back from Canada, not having played for 2 months and not really thinking about the character prior to starting,
mm-hmm.
that was my mistake.
Oh, yeah.
But by the third night in, most definitely, things were firing again for me.
So do you enjoy playing the character?
I do. I think he was very easy, though, to fall into a cliche of the character, which is basically he's going to be the roadblock to Mangold and Buble, the two main characters. You know, being in the position of power that he is, it's very easy to try to one-up people or to send such and such off on this thing or to give an award to that person, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a shorthand that you could use that benefited the storyline, but I don't think particularly benefited the development of the character. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think I'm rambling at this stage. Let me just pat myself on the back, though.
Yeah, that's coming through.
Good.
No, I found Lestrange very easy to fall into because he's a very physical character.
Mm-hmm.
So he's all about the pose.
Yeah.
Like you stick those spindly little Tyrannosaurus Rex hands up in front of him, open your eyes really wide and tilt your head back, and it's pretty much a shoo-in. You've got him.
We didn't share a scene
at
once.
All.
Not once. Well, I think we were on during a group scene. We might share the stage, but we never
interacted with each other.
Not once.
And that's because Lestrange and Dean are not going to. They're too far away from each other, and everyone interacts with the show through the two main characters, Mangold and Buble. And we had no link. Our links were too tenuous. We were like 3 degrees of separation from each other.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we were to have a scene together, I don't really know what that would be. It would just be two people awkwardly going, you're from the hospital, right?
Mm, mm.
Although it would be a fun challenge.
Yeah. two very different characters in terms of their status as well.
Mm.
So, I mean, we could have played that up. Lots of good things. That didn't happen.
I don't know, because we're both low-status characters to some extent, because Dean takes the low status because he's an idiot, so he's always wrong, and he plays it as a high-status character,
yes.
But I'm not sure whether he is the high-status character.
No, he's not.
Because it's not like Mangold's ever subservient to him.
Well, I guess that was an issue that I had in the first season, mm-hmm. that realistically, with the title of medical superintendent, at some point, you know, Mangold has to fall in line.
Like, uh-huh.
like at some point, realistically, in a medical situation, surely Dean would say, look, enough's enough, fall in line. I never really felt that my character was effective against Mangold in that area. And so in season two, I didn't really push any of that kind of,
no, yeah,
that's how my character would get an upper hand, or that's how he'd block him. My character just ended up making, I think, indirectly doing things that would hurt Mangold. So he asked Buble out. Rather than stopping Mangold from going out with Buble, you know, he himself asks Buble out, thereby, you know, causing friction.
One thing I noticed by the end of the season, the hero, Burton Mangold, the best damn doctor,
yeah,
he's a bastard.
He's a prick.
He's a horrible, horrible
really
person.
Is.
And no one should want him to succeed.
No one at all. Played beautifully by David Massingham and Anthony Massingham. Or Anthony Massingham? What's the cliffhanger? Yeah. Perhaps not played beautifully by David Massingham.
No, he did a terrible job.
No. Well, what I'm saying is
maybe
Dave wasn't playing Burton Mangold.
Oh, I see what you're getting at.
Yeah. If you didn't see the show, it's very convoluted, but wide open for season three if we ever go ahead with it.
Yeah, well, it's already been confirmed, apparently.
Oh.
Well, in the show that
In the show.
Greg said, come back next season for Prognosis Death, Pandemic. Mm-hmm. And everyone on stage is like, really? That's been decided? And apparently it has. I looked on Greg's blog and the Brisbane Arts Theatre want us back next year.
Cool.
So hopefully everyone will be around.
I'd say so. Just to take a step back from it, I mean, because as you said, there's probably going to be three or four podcasts of how wonderful it was.
I hope not. I'm going to try to avoid that.
Let's try not.
Let's try to hog it all this time.
But speaking more generically,
now let's not forget that Natalie did this. Did more cartwheels.
Cartwheels.
Don't forget to talk about how brilliant Natalie was in this.
Cartwheels, fly kicks.
Maybe I should get rid of that tone in my voice too.
Yeah, maybe actually with it.
I've got to say that my scenes with Natalie were absolutely wonderful this year. I didn't get many because the new relationship for Lestrange and Carmichael kind of took over my character, but. Then in the last couple of shows, I got to do scenes with Nat, and they're probably my favourite scenes of the entire thing. Although Amy did a beautiful job as Carmichael.
Amy and Wade were probably my two favourites to share a stage with. Not so much that I didn't enjoy Dave and Nat. That's nothing could be further from the truth.
Yep.
But just there was a new relationship between Melody Carmichael and Harold Dean, and so that was great to play that on stage with Amy. And then Wade's character of the reverend or the priest or the whatever he was,
rabbi or vicar.
Yeah, that was just a lot of fun. So I enjoyed following those two relationships down the rabbit hole and see where they came out. Good times. But to take a step back,
yes,
generically, what do you think we've learnt from, say, the Prognosis Death long form show? Do you think everyone else has learnt anything from it? Has it applied those things to the other long forms that we do?
We don't know yet.
Well, I mean, there was a long form before I went away. There was the Agatha Holmes.
Yep.
I think there's another something else coming up in August.
I don't think anyone knows what it is yet.
Not yet.
Natalie was supposed to be doing her Pride and Prejudice, sort of a Jane Austen show, but then she forgot that she was going to swan off around Asia for 3 weeks.
That's right. She's going overseas.
Bitch.
Having fun.
Having a holiday.
Generically, what have we learned from Prognosis Death as a company, do you think? Is there anything to be learned from Prognosis Death?
I don't know. Fake blood's pretty funny.
Fake blood gets good audiences.
That always amazed me. There's basically a joke in Prognosis Death where if someone dies, they'll be immediately covered in blood. And if they don't die near the edge of stage, then a huge stream of blood, fake blood, will pirouette across the stage and land on them. And every single time Greg did that, the audience would split their sides in laughter. Every single time. It's such a simple joke.
It is. It worked.
Every time.
You know what I was glad for, though? I'm glad that we actually stayed away from just playing it for laughs. Like, we could have gone through the motion that every time Dave comes on stage, my character says, Mangold, and shakes his fist, you know. There was a little bit of that because the audience expects it from the character you give them a little bit of what they want, but you've still got to find your own way and do what makes
too much
you happy.
Fan service will ruin anything good.
We'll absolutely ruin.
That was something that was pointed out to us by Greg one night. He said, look, you're going out there and you're not letting your characters change because you're worried that the audience are there for your characters. The audience are there for the show. Just let your characters die. Come back as something else.
Bring back
the whimsy.
Yeah, because you're not actually dead. Your character's dead, but only for this one night.
You
come back tomorrow, you're someone else. It's the beauty of improv in that particular format that we were playing, whereby I was a rat catcher one scene, and then the very next scene I was back to being Harold Dean.
Indeed.
And my rat catcher character died, but no one gets confused. You know, it's all pretty straightforward.
Because of the hats.
The hats, obviously.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I think we possibly forgot, that at least in the first show back, that we didn't have to be those characters.
Mm.
We could be anything we wanted to be. But we were looking forward to putting those comfortable shoes back on and,
yeah,
and getting back out there.
The other thing was that in the first season, Doctor Lestrange had two or three episodes where his character had almost nothing to do.
Mm.
And so I was spending most of my time playing other characters. But in this one, suddenly I had both my relationship with Buble, my relationship with Lestrange, and my new relationship with Dr. Carmichael.
Mm.
And suddenly I was spending ages on stage doing important stuff for the story.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was quite a relief when I got bumped off quite early on in the fifth night.
I actually really enjoyed the night where Dean was supposed to be the third main character.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the most fun I had playing Dean. The reason for that was that for being the third major character, and I'm using the air quote marks,
yep,
he really wasn't. That night, I think Mikey's character of Billy, the child with the sickness,
yes,
which no one can actually nail down what that is, but we know that he coughs blood on people.
Oh, yeah.
He does it all the time.
But only when it's comically...
Only when it's guaranteed to get a laugh, yeah, that's when Billy coughs. But that night, I thought Mike actually carried the show character-wise far more than my character did, in which case I was supposed to be a third character. I did have a B storyline going through there. I didn't have the A story. I had the B story going through there. I felt no pressure to perform in terms of, oh, my character must be involved somehow.
Yeah.
I was just quite happy to float through there and go in and discover what this relationship was that was happening with me in the B story and go from there. Those are the parts that I really enjoyed. That's what I was happy with as well, that for a supposedly, you know, third character, he really wasn't. And I just got to play.
Now, I keep hearing about these crab cakes. I must have missed this scene. What's the story of the crab cakes?
To be honest with you, it's not a very good story. My character was treating Dave's character, so my character of Harold Dean,
yeah,
was actually agreeing with
Mangold,
Burton Mangold, and my character never does that. And the only justification I had for it, it's an awful justification, but the only justification I had for it was that my character had been eating crab cakes earlier, so therefore that's why he wasn't feeling himself and he was sick. And so he knew that he wasn't himself.
This is the wonderful thing about impro, is that when put on the spot, people panic,
yeah,
and the most ridiculous stuff comes out of their head.
Yeah.
And the audience sits there and goes, oh, that would never have come out of my head, but it does make some sort of sense within this broken universe.
And it's one of those things whereby, I think I was talking to you before the third show, I think it was, whereby on a really good night, improv's alchemy, whereby you're turning lead into gold and you're turning these disparate audience offers that might be leprechauns on a shark, you know, the worst dirt material available to you, and you get gold out of it. The magic happens, and the magic is just listening and responding and you know, moving things forward.
Mm-hmm.
We all know, as improvisers, you know how the magic works, but you look back and you go, how did we get from that to this?
Yeah, I was always amazed that we'd spend the second half talking about what could potentially happen in the second half.
The intermission, like, you mean?
Yeah.
So we spent the intermission talking about the second half.
Yeah. And then going, all right, well, where are we now? And what do we know about sirens? And and what sort of set pieces could we set up for our players to play within?
Mm-hmm.
And we'd possibly get quite a strong storyline happening at that point. And then we get up on stage and then someone would fuck up and the entire thing would go off the rails and would just be another mess. And then somehow we'd manage to pull it all together in the end and it made more sense than if we'd kept to our plans.
See,
which we never did
Never did. And I actually enjoy that. My preference actually in this particular format of the show is that at intermission we just go over what we had done.
Mm-hmm.
Because that will then continue to be what you will be doing.
I think it's nice to have like that backup plan. I think that takes the nerves off people where they don't know what to do next, and then suddenly when they jump up on stage, the natural stuff takes over because they're not worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that planning actually provides a useful function.
Oh, look, I don't disagree, but I do disagree.
Oh, fair enough.
I do think that if you have a beat or maybe two beats that you might hit, so rather than something specific and tangible, you have, okay, well, at some point you guys are going to have a fight and then you'll end up at the Aztec temple. Yep. That's enough for me to go, okay, cool, well, we're on the same page. We know where we've been.
Mm-hmm.
We know the trail of breadcrumbs that we're going to follow.
Yeah.
Let's go.
And I also like the opportunity where you can sit around and say, I'd like to do this scene with this character.
Mm-hmm.
And people go, oh, maybe. Or they'll go, oh, that sounds like great fun.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like everyone sits around and MCs a short form show of scenes that happen to join together into a larger story.
Yeah.
And because everyone's on the same page, they do.
And the good thing too about it was even in intermission when we're going over what we had done, and I don't want to say planning the second half because it was an improv show. And,
yeah.
And what happened on stage, very rarely, you know, was it beat for beat what we actually discussed backstage. It was just, you know, spitballing or throwing things against the wall to see what sticks.
Yep.
But even when there was disagreements or, you know, or even, you know, other ideas or dissenting points of view, it wasn't so that my character could move forward or it wasn't so that, you know, I could get more stage time or that doesn't gel with me. It was, how do we service this story?
Yeah.
What are the relationships we already have? How do we move these?
You know? Now, Greg told me the other night that he'd never seen you angry before, but when he stuffed up your scene involving a puppet in the car, that he saw a side of Luke Allen that he never wanted to see again.
Yeah.
Angry, sexy.
It would look
big it, angry.
There was... It was just something whereby I knew that we were short on time and that we were supposed to be wrapping up the first half.
Yep.
And it was one of those things whereby everyone agreed on it and through no one's fault, the director wasn't there when we agreed on how the scene was going to go. And so then when it was about to happen, I'm on stage thinking that it's gone ahead with what we've agreed.
Yep.
Lights come on and nothing is what we've just agreed. And so it's kind of like if someone has just initially it felt like someone had just denied all my offers.
Oh, right.
So I've just, you know, I've said, "Oh, what a lovely day today." And you said, "No." Or I've said, "Well, that's an interesting hat you're wearing. You're saying I'm not wearing a hat." You know, that's what it felt like. All of a sudden I'm on stage. The show itself, I don't think had been going all that well. And so this was just another thing of, sorry, that's probably an overstatement.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like, holy crap, won't someone just pay attention, listen to what's going on? You know, that's what we do as improvisers is listen.
Yep.
Let's listen to what the offer was and move it. And then so, but what can you do, you know? So it didn't go the way that I'd said it might go off stage. Who cares, you know? My character comes back
on. Was there a moment where you forgot that?
Yes.
There's a moment where I forgot that on, I think, the fourth night.
Yeah, no.
Came off backstage and I'm like, what the fucking fuck was that fucking fuck?
Yeah, look.
Who decided that? And you go, wait a second. It's improv.
Yeah.
We could probably recover from that.
I think we can, you know, make amends.
I think that's okay.
I think we can, you know, just pick these pieces
it's
up.
It's not like we were doing Macbeth and someone started doing a scene from Hamlet.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. But for that moment that I was caught in it, you know, and I'm very much a player who plays off positive energy, as I've said before, and I'm very much a player who plays off my own confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So if I personally am not enjoying a show, that affects my own confidence in the show and most definitely affects my confidence in my playing. And it just continues to spiral down into this in a shame spiral. And so
you're too hard on yourself.
No,
man.
But I just
too hard on
you
yourself.
Know, for a moment, I just got lost in it, and then after that, you just go, "Oh fuck it." Can I say that?
Restart. I just did quite a lot.
Spasmo. So and you know you get lost in it, and there was a flare of I guess you know disappointment or anger or whatever that Greg saw, and then you just get over it. What are you going to do? Come on, it's improv.
We probably shouldn't go too much longer without talking about Chris Anderson's amazing work
in the show. And Nathan's.
And Nathan. Nathan pitched in and when Chris was unavailable. But Chris just got far too keen.
Incredibly keen.
Far too keen. Like in that he, I asked him months ago to possibly do up a medley of some of the music he'd been doing for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And he put together a medley and then got so keen that he started designing badges for the hospital and then redoing the medley. And then Nathan got keen and started doing the, and redid
a remix
of the medley with orchestral stuff in it.
Yeah.
And then Tim Witherspoon, who did the original theme song, heard these guys and went back and redid the original theme song. And it's basically like a musician pissing contest. Chris is providing ringtones now. I'm going to try to put them on the website for people who can't get enough of that music.
It's a really fortunate situation, though, to be in that we have musicians and you know musical accompaniment that are so involved, that are so willing to get involved with the show, you know, take this little piece in their own direction, but still come back in and it all ties in beautifully and it adds so much. Both Nathan and Chris's playing added so much to the scenes. It's kind of like the ye olde pianist in the front of the
movie.
Yeah. Whereby they didn't have sound, so it was just that guy.
You're not allowed to boo in movies anymore. You're not supposed to sit there and boo the bad guy. You go to IMAX and start booing Megatron.
Oh god, that was a terrible movie. Oh my god!
If I started booing in that movie, I probably wouldn't stop. Oh, I haven't seen it for the obvious reason that I hated the first one.
I did too.
Why did you go to the second one?
It was.
What were you thinking?
It was.
Didn't you come out of the first one and go, "I hate Michael Bay, and I never want him to benefit from any of my money ever again"?
It was just, well, the first one I wanted to walk out of.
Yeah.
I wanted to walk out of, and none of my friends would come with me. And I didn't want to sit in the car for another 2 hours by myself. So I was like, okay, fine, I'll sit here and swallow this. The second one, I guess it was just, look, it was Transformers 2. Maybe they'd improved some of it. It was always going to be a big blockbuster. I've got no problems with the big blockbuster aspect of it. I have problems with so much of it, though. Ignoring the fact that it's a big blockbuster. Those two racist stereotypes of black people. Of ghetto people, just terrible, just awful. And they should be ashamed to actually, someone spent time modeling that in a 3D program, right? Showing it to their manager and then their manager approved it.
Yes.
And then, okay, that's not the end of it though, because it doesn't stop there.
Can we make a robotic watermelon for these characters?
Can you do that? And can you then put that up, project that onto a 20-foot screen? And they saw it on a 20-foot screen and they didn't stop. And then they released the film. It was terrible. At some point during the process, you go, you know what? We've made a terrible mistake.
It has done no good.
You know, can we pull this? Can we? Let's, you know.
We should probably cut this and put it on the DVD extras.
And the manager's like, what are you talking about? I don't see a problem.
What are you talking about, boy? I want them robot niggers up there.
People talking this all the time. This is how people talk. God, terrible.
You know what that movie needed? More fake blood. Sprayed from the side of the stage.
Yeah, I didn't get enough of slow motion running. I really wish they'd put another 15 minutes of slow motion running in there.
That would kind of defeat the purpose. Like, it's kind of like a visual oxymoron.
It's because it adds to, I don't know, Mikey being the film buff that he is, he'll be able to explain why they do it. Or that panning shot, that low angle panning shot where you look like a hero regardless of if you're opening your car door or you're sneezing.
Oh, yeah.
It's that low angle, sun in the background, sweeping circular motion. Good God, there's enough of that. So Transformers 3 is coming out, though, and I've already pre-booked my tickets.
And time! You have been listening to Luke Allen. Check out Luke Allen at thesexydetective.com.
Thesexydetective.com. Still or we're on Twitter, twitter.com/sexydetective, although that's mainly Dave and Mike.
I'm Dan Beeston. You can check out my website at invisiblespiders.com.
And that's been updated, I've heard.
Updated? It's updated every single day.
Check it out.
Yeah. For news about Impro in Brisbane, go to impromafia.com. Thanks to David Peachy for our theme music. Hosting for End Time is earnestly provided by Civic Net Web Design.
You know what I hate too? Why? Is after this all finishes recording, I'm like, I don't even know what I said. I don't know what he's going to put up. And the first time I think that we recorded this, you sent me like a preview of it, and I was like, yeah, listen to this. If it's okay, we'll throw this up, and it was fine. But ever since then, you haven't. So
no.
I don't know what happens or what I've said until it actually comes down.
It's like a honey trap. I'm Dan Beeston. You can check out my webcomic at www.impromafia. No, shit. Welcome to End Time, a podcast for improvisers and aspiring improvisers. I'm Dan Beeston, Impro Mafia's...
Sorry, I thought you were introducing me.
Why would I do that?
I'm
the important one.
Go from the top. Let's do it again.
Welcome to
Hello!
God damn you.